This morning, in this first hour of the program, our guest is Dr. Linnea Smith. She grew up in Wisconsin. She went to med school there and started practicing medicine. And as she explains, chances are, if things had gone differently, she'd still be there and she would be happily living in Wisconsin and practicing medicine. But her life took a big change, took a big turn in 1990 when she went to Peru on an ecotourism vacation. She was so moved and so impressed by what she saw there, she decided to give up her practice in Wisconsin to provide health services in a remote area of the Amazon rainforest. She's written about this in a book titled La Doctora, An American Doctor in the Amazon, and it's published by the University of Minnesota Press. She did an interview some time ago. This was actually back in Wisconsin that caught the attention of some folks there who were involved with Rotary. And they contributed some resources to the work that she was doing. And from then, other Rotary organizations, different places, have done the same. And that's really why it is that she is here in Champaign-Urbana. She'll be speaking to a Rotary District Conference. This is at the Holiday Inn in Urbana at noontime today. And the folks were good enough to let us know that she was going to be here and give us a chance to talk with her. And I thought it's a pretty good story and thought people would enjoy hearing it. So we asked her to be here on the show, and she said yes, she would. Questions, of course, are welcome if people want to call in during the time that she's here. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You begin the story with a rather harrowing account of your first C-section, something that I guess when you go through your basic medical training, you get a little bit of training in everything. But unless you specialize in something, you probably don't go and spend lots and lots of time doing it. Had you been involved in any births at home in your practice before you went to the Amazon?
No, not at all. My field was internal medicine, and we do, their slogan now is doctors for adults. We take care of your heart attacks, we take care of your cancer, we take care of your kidney problems, we take care of your strokes, we take care of your deep venous thrombosis, we take care of your high blood pressure, your cholesterol. We don't do surgery. We don't, as a rule, deal with children, and we definitely don't do babies.
Mm-hmm. So not only were you forced into a situation to deal with something that you hadn't done before, but you were doing it under less than ideal conditions in terms of everything from equipment that you didn't have to lighting, which you didn't have, and sterile conditions, which you didn't have.
That's correct. Yes, it was an adventure. In fact, I tell people now that not to let the American College of Physicians, which is the group for internal medicine doctors, not to let them know that my heart does not race at the words, I can't have my baby, because they would probably not consider me a true internist if I didn't get tachycardic when I heard that phrase. Hmm.
So this must have been one of the times when you asked yourself, why? Why am I here? Why am I doing this? Or maybe not ask a question like that, but ask this question, am I really equal to this task? Is this something that I can actually do?
Oh, yeah, I was asking that a lot. In fact, I was very grateful that I was busy enough for most of those hours that I didn't have enough time to really think about it too much, because it was pretty terrifying.
Yeah. Well, let's take back a couple steps then, and the next thing that you do in the book is just go back to talking about how it is that you went there in the first place. Mm-hmm. So you just were thinking, when this was in 1990, you were just thinking, well, this was a vacation, and you were interested in seeing this part of the world, and you hadn't thought anything more than just that, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. I had been out of school for a number of years. And the last thing that I did before I went back to school and then decided that I wanted to be a doctor when I grew up, if I ever did grow up, was for 3 years I had a store where I sold houseplants, orchids, bromeliads, cactuses, ferns, epiphytic plants, ones that grow hanging on to other plants for support, were a particular interest of mine. So when I got to be a doctor and actually for the first time in many years had an income and could take vacations, I was attracted by a Nature Conservancy tour to the Amazon. And I said, I'll go see where my plants all came from. Mm-hmm. And after being there for a week, I decided I didn't want to go home again, which was really stupid because I came from a clinic in the United States where we had running water, we had electricity, we had x-ray in-house, we had lab in-house, we had nurses, we had assistants, we had a hospital next door. If there was something that our hospital couldn't handle, like neurosurgery, we had med flight. Where I was interested in being in the Amazon, there were none of those things. There were houses with thatch roofs, palm thatch roofs. There was no electricity. There were kerosene lamps. There was, you know, no nurses, no pharmacists, no running water, no x-ray, no med flight, no lab. And I didn't speak Spanish.
That's an awful lot on the – if you made two columns of the pros and cons, on the cons, that would be an awful lot of things to say to you. Is this really – can I do this? Is this really a good idea? It seems that on the other side was simply that something about this place grabbed hold
me,
of you.
Yes.
And you said to yourself, well, I have these skills that are needed, so I can not only stay in this place that now has grabbed me, but I can actually do something that would be positive and make a contribution to the people who are living there.
Yeah, that's about it. We don't need to do the interview. You've got it all down.
Well, no. I think there's a between there and the details. Now there's a lot of room for continuing to tell stories. Well, if I guess I'm curious about how much of this really truly was it something about the place grabbed you, and if you had, you know, can you imagine having gone to some other place in the world, some very different sort of place, and made that same decisions? How much of it was that there was a need, you saw there was a need and you thought, well, I'm a doctor, I can do something about mm-hmm. this, that it was that, or that it was just something about the, you know, the majesty and the mystery of the place that grabbed you so much that made you want to first and foremost, it made you want to stay. Mm-hmm. And then you said, well, here's this thing that I can be doing.
Exactly. I mean, there's need everywhere. There is need in all sorts of places in this country. Even in Madison, Wisconsin, which is the nearest large city to where I lived in Wisconsin, where we're a relatively well-off population, there are still pockets of poverty. There are people working in clinics for the migrant workers, for people with no income. And if you get out of the United States, you can go to any country you want, anywhere in the world, and find lots and lots of need. So you're right. It wasn't only the fact that there was need, although in that area of Peru, the need is fairly stunning. It was more like the place, somehow the place and the people grabbed hold of me. And I tell people it's kind of like falling in love. You can say, well, there's this reason and that reason and the other reason that I'm attracted. But then there's also this magic factor, mm-hmm. this chemistry that you really can't explain, but is there. And Peru exerted that on me. And after 14 years and plenty of exposure to the drawbacks, I still feel that magic. I still go out walking in the rainforest when I'm feeling kind of grim and glumpy, and 10 or 15 minutes of doing that and everything just sort of settles down and gets to feeling much better.
Well, I'm sure that part of it has to do with this match between you and the place. And you can imagine other people would have that same sort of feeling, but would have a feeling about a different sort of a place. Mm-hmm. I could imagine that some people in that place would feel threatened by it, or feel kind of frightened by it, or just because it would be so very different from everything that they had known, the places that they had grown up, different plants, different animals, different sorts of problems, different way of life, that it would, a lot of people would find it very difficult to make that adjustment and wouldn't automatically embrace it.
Well, you do have to have a little sense of adventure. I confess that coming back to the United States, one of the things I really like now is if I get up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, I don't need a flashlight and I don't have to watch for snakes. So you do have to have a little bit of a sense of adventure. But it's a beautiful place, and you don't have to shovel snow in the winter. And I look out my back door sometimes and see saddleback tamarins, little monkey creatures, climbing up the palm trees. I mean, that's pretty neat. And it's not a it's not a threatening or a dangerous place. Tourists always write and ask, well, what do I need, you know, in terms of vaccines and so forth before I go down there? And I say, well, you know, take your malaria medicine just because there's a very small chance. But I've lived there for 14 years and I don't take malaria medicine. Mm-hmm. If I ever get malaria, it'll get diagnosed and there's, you know, it's treatable disease. And I haven't had it. There are poisonous snakes, and I treat poisonous snake bites. There are little scorpions. There are tarantulas. But, you know, I've never been bitten by a snake or a scorpion. I'm a Wisconsin girl, and I've lived there for all of this time and not been attacked by anything. And the people are very nice. It's not exactly a hotbed of women's liberation. South America is very much a macho, male-dominated society. On the other hand, I think it's not nearly as repressive as most Muslim countries. And women do have a great deal of freedom. And as a foreigner and as a professional, I am respected and although there's not women's liberation, there's also not discrimination against women. I think the Peruvian males haven't had a chance to encounter that many women in the marketplace or in professional areas. And so when they do, they're not accustomed to trying to keep them back. They let them go ahead and do their thing. Mm.
Well, that you touch on what I'm sure would be a natural question that a lot of people would have was there some difficulty, any difficulty in people accepting you as a doctor and something of a, I don't know if authority figure is the right word to use, but the fact that accepting you as a, not just as a doctor, but as a woman doctor.
Not really, because as I say, there are women doctors, there are women lawyers, there are women businessmen in Central and South America. The women, the poor women, have a hard time getting out of their home. You know, out where I am, there are no jobs. Once you have a baby, you're stuck. It takes all day to cook and wash the clothes. You literally can't do anything. But if you get into the city, there are some jobs to be had, and women do that. And as a foreigner, sadly to me, that's actually an advantage. I always talk to the visitors about how wealthy this country is. You know, every house has running water. You probably have in your kitchen a stove, a refrigerator, a microwave, an oven, and a sink. None of my patients has one of those things, let alone all of them. We also have, because of being a very wealthy country, a very good educational system, and we have incredible technology. We buy American proudly. But that's easy to do because if you've got the money, and things are getting really expensive in this country, but that's a whole other subject. But if you've got the money, you can get anything, and it's really well made. In Peru, that isn't true. You get a Peruvian pair of tennis shoes, it falls apart the first time you wear them. Anyone would much rather have an imported pair of shoes. You get a Peruvian stereo, it falls apart the first time you use it. Anyone would much rather have an imported stereo. You get a Peruvian medicine, it may be laundry starch mixed with soap and put into a tablet in a box that has a counterfeited label on it. We'd rather have an imported medicine. So would you rather have a Peruvian doctor or an imported doctor? No contest.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Dr. Linnea Smith. She's a physician. As I began with a little bit of her story, she was born and raised in Wisconsin and went to med school and started practicing medicine. And then in 1990, she went to Peru on vacation and was so taken by the place she decided she wanted to go back there and to practice medicine. And she's written about her experiences in a book titled La Doctora, An American Doctor in the Amazon. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. So if you'd like to read it, you can certainly head on to the bookstore and look for it. And of course, questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think here in the United States, if you were, say, if you were practicing medicine in Wisconsin and you decided you wanted to move to Texas and set up a practice, you couldn't just do that. You couldn't just move and hang out a shingle in Texas. If you're going to go to, say, from Wisconsin to Peru, how exactly do you do that? Because you need equipment, you need a place to practice, and then do you need to be licensed? Do you need the government to say, okay, Dr. Smith, welcome, thank you very much? How exactly do you do that?
Well, If you're going to a rural area, 50 miles outside of a city that is literally plunked in the middle of the rainforest with no roads leading to it, then you sort of hide out and hope not to be discovered. The attitude of the Peruvian authorities was always, from the first, we can't get Peruvian doctors to go out and work in the area where you are. So if you want to do it and you're not costing us any money and you're bringing in medicines, more power to you. Now, the bureaucratic aspects are a little different. For the first 7 years that I was there, had anyone complained about my service, I could have wound up in a Peruvian jail, which we don't even want to think about. But no one did. And as I say, even in those first years when I did not have an official Peruvian recognition of my doctor status, I was getting, for instance, family planning supplies and occasionally IV fluids and malaria medicines from the rural medicine programs run by the government, which is the sort of contradiction in terms, giving medicine to somebody that you think is probably a doctor but doesn't really have any legal standing, never happened in this country. But this country is civilized. This country is developed. Why I fly over this country when I come back for a visit and I see lights and strings of lights and roads connecting cities to Peru is not like that. You fly over northern South America and you see nothing but rainforest for hours. So we're in remote areas. Government inspectors don't come out and check. And as I say, they can't get Peruvian doctors to come out and work where I am. So that's how that worked. And then after a great deal of bureaucratic maneuvering, I got recognized and I am legally a physician in Peru. Materials, yes, well, I started with literally what I could carry in my arms. And I have a photograph, I'll show it to the Rotarians a little later, that the first day that I was down there, I was there initially for a week as a tourist, decided I wanted to stay, said, no, Linnea, that's really stupid. Go back home and you'll come to your senses. I got back to Wisconsin. I still wanted to be back in Peru. So I arranged eventually with Explorama, the tour company that I had visited initially, to live in their lodge and take care of people there, and ask my partners for a 3-month leave of absence, thinking that I would get back down to Peru and things would be different and I would come to my senses then, surely. So I went back down with literally what I could carry in my suitcase. And the first day that I was there, I put it on the little table outside the little 8.5 by 11 foot room that was going to be my alleged clinic. And I stood back and I took photograph of this little pitiful armload of stuff in this open space. And I said, boy, maybe my partners were right and I really am crazy. And it's grown gradually.
Yeah. It sounds like you took your basic medical tools.
You took a doctor's black bag.
Think you could take people's blood pressure.
Yep.
Someone that you had worked with had a microscope.
Yep.
An old-fashioned one that just worked off ambient light from when he was in med school. I said, fine, here, take my microscope.
We're still
you took
using
some
that
basic
one.
Some basic medicines and just what you could get into two suitcases and went.
Mm-hmm.
That must have I can't quite imagine how you must have felt when you think, what in the world here? How am I
and
going to?
And let's not forget, I didn't speak the language and I didn't know anyone. It was a completely strange and different environment.
So how did you initially, obviously must have depended on somebody to translate for you.
Well, when I decided that I wanted to go back to Peru, I looked for ways to get to that area, and I couldn't find any. Peace Corps was kicked out in the late 60s and didn't go to Peru. The Nature Conservancy didn't need a doctor in that area. I'm not particularly religious, but I couldn't even find any religious programs that were in that region. So I finally contacted the lodge where we had stayed as tourists. And I said, what would you charge me? Just room and board. No guides, no excursions. I just want to come down. I'm a doctor, and I was there. Maybe you remember me because I gave snake antivenom to one of your employees who was bitten at the time. And so they, you know, told me what they would give for room and board. And so for the first few months there, the guides came with tourists, and they, of course, are bilingual. They speak English as well as Spanish. And I would get them to translate for me, which was sometimes a bit of a challenge because the guides are all male. had a woman come in with urinary tract infection or some female problems. They got a little antsy sometimes. But it worked. And I, in fact, and when there were days when there were no tourists at that lodge, when they would all be gone to another lodge, I tended to go with the group because I was terrified some patient would come in and I wouldn't be able to talk to them. Fortunately for me, Spanish is a very easy language for an English-speaking person to learn. And within a few months, I could at least ask people about their pain or their diarrhea or their fever, even though I could not have really talked literature or politics. So, people helped me.
We are about midway already in this part of Focus 580. We have a caller we get right to, someone listening in Indiana. Let's just go there on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. It's nice to see somebody doing what you're doing. I was wondering if there was any problems with, I guess I'll just call it folk medicine, in terms of what you brought from the scientific aspect of it, whether you had any problem at all of getting people to take medicines or a shot or anything like that. I know a lot of this may be dependent upon, you know, Hollywood's view of everything. When you're brought up, you know, you think every place is, you know, they're pulling leaves off of trees, mashing them up, and, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm just wondering if that sort of thing's going on or whether, you know, they're ready for you without any questions whatsoever.
Some of both. The shamans and the naturalists and the curanderos are certainly very active. And, you know, as I mentioned, there are no roads out where I am. If you live in Manatee, the village across the river from me, you have to cross 2 miles of river across a very strong current. It may take you 4 hours in your dugout canoe to get to me. If it's the middle of the night and raining, you may stay home and have the witch doctor take care of you for a few days. And then if you don't get better, come in. You also have people who, you know, there's no ambulances and you don't just call MedFlight or 911. You also have people who are very traditional, who don't really believe in modern medicine. I had one Yagua Indian woman a few years ago who came in every month or so to have a gallon or so of fluid drained off her belly. She had tuberculosis, and I assume, you know, we don't have any autopsies there, but I assume she had peritoneal studding. She had tuberculosis implanted in her abdominal cavity, and she would get fluid collecting there until her belly was so swollen that she would barely breathe. She'd come in, and I'd take it off. And I tried to get her to take the modern medicine for tuberculosis, but she didn't really believe in that. Germ theory doesn't really register. And so she was going to the witch doctor, and I've had more than one patient die while being taken care of the witch doctors when modern medicine might have helped them, at least if they'd gotten it earlier. And that's kind of sad. On the other hand, I think people have a right to make their own decisions based on their own world beliefs. And, you know, even in this country, if you say, no, you know, I've thought about it, and I don't think that the chance of getting better with my, say, melanoma from chemotherapy is much good. I don't want to do that. I think people have a right to do that. So it is kind of sad when you see folks who, you know, could be helped and refuse it. I was talking to someone earlier this morning about vaccines. We have a number of people who don't bring their children in to be vaccinated because, well, she's going to cry, and then she might get a fever that night. And I say, yeah, but she'd cry for 10 minutes. It's not that big a hurt. If there's a fever, we can give her Tylenol. We can get, and if she gets tetanus, she'll die. But mom says, well, she's not going to get tetanus. That's not a real thing. That's somewhere in the future. It's not here and now. Her crying here and now is real. And so, no, I'm not going to do that. And that's a problem with lack of education. Human nature is such that whatever is immediately on top of us is what we believe in. And the less educated we are, the stronger that belief is. And education moves very slowly in the area where we are. Hmm.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here, and again, maybe for the benefit of anybody who might have tuned in, I should introduce again our guest, Dr. Linnea Smith. She grew up in Wisconsin, practiced medicine there in 1990, went to Peru on vacation, and was so captivated by the place, she decided she wanted to go back and be a doctor there. And she has been providing medical services to people who live in the Amazon in the time since. She's written a book about her experiences titled La Doctora, An American Doctor in the Amazon. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. early on in her experiences, she came back and she did an interview on a public radio station. Imagine that, in Wisconsin. And as a result, someone who was involved with Rotary heard the interview and said, well, that sounds like a good thing. We'd like to provide some support. And since that time, other Rotary organizations in different places have also provided some support. And she is here to speak at the Rotary District Conference in Urbana, taking place at the Holiday Inn in Urbana. So that's why she is here. So, and if you're interested in reading this book and reading more about what has happened to her, you can do that. Go out to the bookstore and look at it and look for it. But of course, here, if you're in Champaign-Urbana or any place else, you can hear us if you want to call in. You can do that, too. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm sure that there is all manner of complaints that people come to you with, a lot of the same things I'm sure that you might see in Wisconsin if you're practicing medicine there. Some things also I'm sure that are different. What are some of the most common diseases or medical conditions that you end up treating?
Well, it's a wide variety of illnesses. It's virtually all acute illness rather than chronic. In this country, I see a lot of people with high blood pressure and glaucoma and prostate cancer and diabetes. Many of those things don't really give symptoms. If you hadn't had an exam, you wouldn't know you had them. And so in the Amazon, you don't know you have them if you do, but also you don't live long enough in the Amazon to get them. So mostly acute illness. I feel sick, which means a lot of infectious diseases. And some of those are very mild and some are very severe. If I were to count intestinal parasites, that would be the most common thing that we see because virtually everyone has them. In the Amazon, if a 2-year-old child is there with a pneumonia and she coughs and a 6-inch long worm falls out of her mouth, we say, oh, you need your worm medicine. If it happened in Wisconsin, your nurse would faint. We also see a great deal of diarrheal illnesses and respiratory illnesses in small children. When women come in for family planning in the Amazon, I have to ask them, how many living children do you have? How many dead children do you have? How many of your babies have not survived? Infant mortality is very high. And you lose older kids with accidents, with snake bites, with dying in childbirth. But the biggest mortality is in the little ones. And a lot of that is diarrheal illnesses and respiratory illnesses. They get diarrheal illnesses because they're not always boiling the Amazon before drinking it. There is no plumbing. For us, running water is the Amazon River. You go down in the morning with a bucket and you bring it back in, on top of your head into your house, and that's your drinking water. And over the years, more and more people are realizing they're supposed to boil their water, but not everyone does. You also get diarrheal illnesses because nutrition is not ideal. People do not starve to death like in Africa. There are fish in the river still, although fewer than they used to be and smaller. People raise their plantains, their cooking bananas, and their yucca, but they don't have dairy products. There's no refrigeration. You don't have ice cream. You don't have milk. You don't have yogurt. You don't have cheese. They don't have green vegetables. They don't go to grocery stores and get stuff that's been imported from other places. They only have what they raise here now. So they're borderline malnourished. They have calories from the yucca and the plantain. They have protein from the fish, but they don't have trace elements. They don't have iron. They don't have calcium. They don't have vitamins. And so I think their immune systems not function as well. And then the respiratory illnesses, again, the malnutrition plays into that and the diarrhea plays into that. If you're a small child and you have diarrhea, you're losing much of the nutrients that you should be absorbing. And as I say, you need all you can get since you don't have extra like in this country. And so respiratory illnesses are frequent and frequently fatal if not treated. So we see a lot of that. Then we see other infectious diseases ranging from fungal skin infections, very popular in a warm, humid climate, athlete's foot, tinea versicolor, crotch rot, groin itch. We see abscesses, and some of them are amazing. Again, I think the immune systems of my patients do not function as well as those of people in this country because of the lack of nutrition. And we see horrendous abscesses. You drain a liter of fluid out of an abscess. We see meningitis every now and again. We see otitis media, otitis externa. We see a little bit of trauma, machete cuts. I had a kid come in about a year ago. Everyone around knows where I live. And so this man came to my door early one morning, said, "Doctor, my son cut his finger and it won't stop bleeding." And I said, "Fine, I'll have breakfast. I'll be right down there." Got to the clinic. It turned out that the boy, while cutting firewood so that his mom could cook breakfast, had cut off the distal bone of his thumb, which is half of his thumb. In the States, you would send that to an orthopedic surgeon for repair. And instead, I knew that this family had no chance of going to Iquitos for medical care. So I sort of improvised a repair of that. We see a little bit of tropical medicine, specifically tropical medicine. Malaria, not very much, but there's some each year. We haven't seen a case of cholera for a number of years, but we did have a few cases of that. I've seen a few cases of leprosy and leishmaniasis. And the first year I was there, there was a big outbreak of dengue. And dengue, it's a viral illness. It's a kind of a super flu. You get high fevers. Your head really hurts. Your eyes feel like golf balls of pain. And every bone in your body has been crunched up and put back, still crunched. And you can feel them crunching around as you move. It's a very interesting illness. But it's a viral illness and you get over it.
Yeah, only a doctor would say that. It's a very interesting illness.
Well, it's because I had it, so I know you do survive it.
Oh, I see. So you know from personal experience.
Yes.
Well, you know, it makes me think about it, the fact that now probably if you ask people about, you know, what are the things that have come along that really have improved human health and why it is that here in the United States we have the level of health we do. And I'm sure a lot of people would say, well, that's about, it's technology, you know, it's science that has done that. But you forget, I think people really forget that the things that came along that really produced dramatic advances in human health didn't have to do with antibiotics and they didn't have to do with CAT scans. They had to do with the fact that the point came when you could have reliable clean water to
Absolutely.
Drink. You know, among the things we take for granted, the fact that you can go right over and you can turn on the tap and you can have an unlimited source of clean water with no more energy than it takes to turn the handle, that and that we do have ways to deal with our waste and get rid of it and keep those two things separate. That was a huge advance in human health that goes on sort of on the level of public health. And I think, again, that's one of the things that we have really, in favor of more advanced kind of medical technology, have de-emphasized and have completely forgotten just how important that has been in keeping people from getting sick.
Oh, absolutely. In this country, it's because everybody in this country has water and has electricity and has grocery stores, so you take that for granted. I tell people that I think everyone in this country should visit any undeveloped country in the world just to see that, no, it's not automatic that you have clean water. Tourists ask me, what do you do about preventive medicine? And they're thinking of mammograms and prostate-specific antigen. And I say, well, the biggest things about preventive medicine in the United States are sewage systems and grocery stores. You have clean water to drink, you have a way to get rid of your waste, and you have food available to you, a variety of food. You can get broccoli any time of year. You can get strawberries any time of year. Your grocery store will never be out of milk. And those are the basics. And then beyond that, vaccines. And then if you want to get really fancy, antibiotics. Sometimes I tell people that practicing medicine in the Amazon is like practicing in the United States 100 years ago, except that I have Cipro. People in this country, again, as you mentioned, people think you can't get better without a CAT scan. And people forget these things are diagnostic tools rather than treatment modalities. But the big advance in medicine in the developed countries has not been all the heart transplants and the fancy x-rays and the this and that. The big advance has been antibiotics. 50 years ago, we did not have antibiotics. Penicillin was developed during World War II. You know, 75 years ago, all the doctor could do if you had a bad illness was hold your hand. If you had type 1 diabetes, you died. Insulin wasn't available till the 1920s. So all of that stuff is very, very recent within the lifetimes of many of us. Not me, of course, I'm far too young to remember any of that stuff. But within the lifetimes of many of us or our parents, we didn't have literally anything that we have now in modern medicine for treating.
Well, you get at something which I think is also a really important point, something that people also need to think about, that it was not all that long ago that physicians like you, you know, the number of tools in their toolkit was much more limited. And as you say, there would have been times when all the doctor could do was hold the patient's hand. Mm-hmm. All you can do was bear witness to their suffering. That would be about it. And I would guess that may be in the kind of position that you're in and the kind of medicine that you do, given what it is you have to work with, that there are times when it isn't, like you say. It's like practicing medicine 100 years ago, except that you do have antibiotics. You do have some medicines and mm-hmm. some drugs that you can use mm-hmm. that your forebears didn't. But in some other ways, it's not that much different.
That's true. And there are certainly more times in Peru than in the United States when I say, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. On the other hand, I hate to break this to you and it's going to be really bad news, but we all die. I have not ever treated one single patient whose life I have saved. Every single one of them is going to die. And even in this country, if you come to me and you're jaundiced and I get your famous CT scan and it turns out you have pancreatic cancer, all I can tell you is, I'm sorry, you're going to die. I'll give you as much narcotics as you need to keep the pain at bay, but you're going to die. We sort of cover that up in this country by saying, well, we can do an operation. And we don't say, we can do an operation and take out some of that pancreatic cancer, but you're still going to die. We don't say, you're going to be spending a lot of time in the hospital, it's going to cost a ton of money, and it's going to hurt you, and there's going to be a lot of things that are very uncomfortable, and you may be nauseated, and you're still going to die. We say, there are things we can do. And there are. In the Amazon, it's a little more stark. We don't have all of those things that we can do in between. If you're a woman who's never had a pap smear and you come in and you say, Doctor, I've had a period for the last 2 years, and I look and I do a pelvic exam and your cervix is a fungating mass and your pelvis is socked in, you have advanced cervical cancer. And even in the United States, if you waited to that point to come for care, you would probably die. In Peru, I may not even have enough medicine to give you good medicine for pain control until you die. So it's a little more stark, but we all do die eventually anyway. So you do in medicine, you know, our aim is, sorry, you guys, I don't mean to disillusion anyone, but our aim is not really to cure you. Our aim is to help you to live with whatever you have in as comfortable fashion as possible, to enjoy whatever life is allotted to you until the point that you do die, which you will eventually reach.
About 15 minutes left in the program. Dr. Linnea Smith is our guest. She's a physician. And again, just to thumbnail sketches, as I mentioned at the beginning a couple times during the program here, she was born and raised in Wisconsin and went to med school and started to practice medicine there until she went on a vacation to Peru. And was so taken with the place, she decided she wanted to go back there, not just to live, but also to practice medicine. And she's been doing that since 1990, and has written a book about it. La Doctora is the title, An American Doctor in the Amazons, published by University of Minnesota Press. So if you'd like to read more about her story, you can do that. And we have a couple of callers here now. Both of them are on cell phones, so we'll get right to it. Line one first. Hello.
Hi, I'd just like to hear your comment on a phrase that I hear all the time that seems very symptomatic of the Western way of doing medicine and seems very wrong-headed. And that is, when people have serious illness, particularly terminal fatal illnesses, people are to talk about them fighting. They're fighting cancer. And it seems to me that that's a completely wrong-headed attitude, and it leads to a lot of emotional suffering, both by the family and by the patient. So could you make a comment on about that kind of phrase and what that indicates about our approach to medicine? Thank you.
Actually, I heard a fellow not long ago who is a physician who works with cancer patients who agrees with you. He really dislikes the phrase fighting the cancer, and it's a battle that you lose and all of that. I think that how each of us deals with or impending deaths. We don't all get warnings. Sometimes we just drop dead. Many of us, however, have chronic illnesses, and how we deal with those and how we deal, in fact, with our lives before we get sick is pretty much a personal issue. And different people have different approaches. If you are diagnosed with cancer and you say, well, you know, we all die of something. This is what I'm going to die of. I'm going to live my life to the fullest before I get there. That's fine. If you say, I don't like this idea and I'm going to hold out as long as I can and I'm going to fight this thing with everything I've got, I think that's okay too. It seems to me that the important thing is that whatever approach you take to your life and or your impending death, it be an approach with which you personally feel comfortable because you're the one that's inside that body. You're the one that's inside that head. You're the one who's living that life.
To line number two. This is also someone on cell phone. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Two questions. Why aren't we, I guess, conditioned to be more receptive to a doctor telling, hey, you're going to die someday anyway? I mean, there's a finite limit to how long you're going to live. The other question I have is, did you or do you use sulfa drugs or have you do you have them available to you?
The sulfa is easy. Yeah, sulfa, in fact, I use mostly sulfa drugs, amoxicillin, Diclox, and I get Cipro brought down by tourists for the diarrhea that they don't get and left with me. I use mostly low-tech, older-fashioned drugs, not the very high-tech, expensive drugs that are available in this country because they're simply not available and because we don't have the kind of resistance to antibiotics in Peru that we do in the United States where we sprinkle drugs around like holy water all the time and get a lot of resistance. Why do we as a nation have a hard time accepting the idea that we're going to die? I think part of that is because, once again, we're a very wealthy, very comfortable nation with lots of technology. We can do heart transplants. We can do surgery for your brain tumor. We can give you chemotherapy for your breast cancer. We have made such strides with technology. It costs a lot of money. But we say, oh, we can't afford it, but we can afford it. We do it every day. We've made such tremendous strides that we've sort of gotten to where, I mean, even though we all know, if we think about it, that, yes, someday I'm going to die, the human body-soul mix has a really hard time actually accepting that. And so we've gotten accustomed to the idea that no matter what it is, there's something we can do to stave it off. I think that what we sometimes forget is the quality of life that's involved and how much are we getting for the money and the suffering that we're going. Is the treatment really worth going through? And for some things it is. If you have an acute leukemia and you're a child, it's worth having your hair fall out and throw up every single day for 3 months on end if you can then live the rest of your life in peace. On the other hand, if you have melanoma, that's widely metastatic, and there isn't any chemotherapy. If you feel better engaging in an experimental program in the hopes that maybe it'll help, then I think more power to you. But if you say, no, there's nothing that's really likely to help, I'm going to just do what I can as long as I can and be done with it, I think that's okay too. But that's all personal decisions again.
Another no mobile phone here, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Quick question. I tuned in late, so maybe you've addressed this question and I haven't heard it yet, but I was wondering about the pharmaceutical companies in the U.S. that are developing high-end kind of luxury drugs like Viagra and Levitrin and all those kind of things instead of low-cost effective drugs for tropical diseases. And there, I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
There's unfortunately, tropical diseases occur in tropical countries, most of which are very poor. There ain't no money there. You know, the United States is a big, there's a big to-do now about people in the United States who are, many of them on fixed incomes, having to buy all these expensive drugs, and they want to know why they can't get cheaper drugs from Canada. I'm sure the Canadians are thinking, well, if you guys want cheaper Canadian drugs, come up here and work for Canadian salaries. We are the wealthiest country in the world. everything here costs a lot of money, but we have a lot of money to spend. And so, yeah, it's worth the drug company's while to develop high-end, pricey drugs for, you know, that they can sell for a lot of money here. It's not worthwhile to develop low-end, cheap drugs that poor countries aren't going to even have the money to pay for in the first place. I'm sorry. It's a simple economic fact.
Next caller is in Chicago, line one. Hello. Yes.
I'm reminded of a personal friend who visited Vietnam and Cambodia during the crisis there about medical conditions and the lack of physicians, and he happened to be a practicing homeopathic physician. Had you ever had occasion to possibly incorporate homeopathic items in your practice?
I really don't use those things or what the local shamans tell me. Just because I have no way to really test those things and get evidence that they work. It's just anecdotal. It's somebody saying, oh, this is really good for that.
Well, like when you say there wasn't anything around 75 years ago, homeopathy is certainly a function and is still thriving today. I think it's something well worth looking into. And as the fact that it's also so inexpensive, too, relative to other medication. In certain areas, it's certainly effective. And I thought I'd remind you of it. That's something. And also, I'm reminded of the efforts of Dr. Schweitzer when he went to Africa. Your description of going to Peru reminded me a bit of his encountering those conditions, having to boil water and so on. So I applaud you for all the good things you're doing. Thank you.
Well, thank you. But I think he played piano a lot better than I do.
Well, thanks for the call. We're coming down to near the end of the show. I guess one of the things that I'm curious about is, now you've been doing this for something like 14 years. How much longer do you see yourself doing this?
Well, I lived there full time for about 11 years, and then for a whole bunch of reasons. I hate to be a wimp, but after 11 years of being on call 24 hours a day, all the days, I was starting to get a little tired of that. I also started to think, as you mentioned, what happens in the next decade, the decade after that. And I realized 10 years and I haven't read an ECG. I pull teeth, I deliver babies, I look at malaria smears, but I haven't read an ECG or run a code. And so for a whole bunch of different reasons, the last few years I'm trying to spend half of the time there and half the time here. So I'm in the States for spring and fall, and the people that I trained now are running the clinic in my absence. And then I come back and I say, you did really good on this, we got to work on this. When I die, or maybe even retire, before I get to dying, who knows. But when I'm no longer at the clinic, I do not know whether it will continue. I do not know whether the work ethic and the various and sundry aspects of Peruvian culture are going to enable it to continue functioning without me. It certainly would not continue to function without an influx of money from the United States. We received on average for our patients last year a little less than 80 cents per person. That's not going to support the clinic. But what I'm trying to do is give more independence to my folks, renew my own modern medical skills in this country, and take it day by day, and we'll deal with it as it comes.
So if somebody came along and said to you, you can't go to Peru to doctor anymore. You can still be a doctor. You can be a doctor here in Wisconsin, and that's fine. But we're just saying, no, that part of your life, we're going to close the door on it. Would you feel a terrible sense of loss if we said to you right now, sorry, you're not going back, but you can go back and treat your patients in Wisconsin?
I would feel a lot better than if I was told I couldn't be a doctor anywhere. Yes, of course I would. I mean, I've got my house there. I've got my years of being there. I've got the patients there. I'm seeing people now that I'm seeing their children when I treated them as children. Another year or two, I'm going to be delivering babies for babies that I delivered. And yes, of course I would miss that. On the other hand, you can't save the world and nothing lasts forever. Rome didn't last forever. Britain wasn't ruler of the seas forever. The United States is not going to realize it for a while yet, but we're not going to be world dominant power forever. Nothing lasts forever. If I were to die today, there are still 25 to 30,000 people in the Peruvian Amazon who received medical care because of my efforts who would not have received medical care otherwise. And so I would say, hey, I didn't save the world, but I did something that was okay. I feel okay about what I did with my life. And you just have to accept that you do what you can, and that's all you can do.
Yeah. I get this feeling that there may be some physicians, perhaps your age or older, particularly people whose experience spans the period before and after the coming of managed care, who are not real happy with how you practice medicine in those sorts of structures, and who might actually say, if they were really being honest, you know, if I had it to do over again, I'm not sure that I would be a doctor. It sounds like you don't have any kind of doubts like that.
Well, I like medicine a lot. There are different kind of bureaucratic constraints in Peru, and if you think there's not bureaucracy, you've never been to an undeveloped country. They make our bureaucracy look pale and weak. Basically, I like medicine. I went into it because I felt like I would feel like I was doing some good because, you know, I mean, you don't save everybody. You can't even help everybody. Some people get mad at you. But I think, would I rather do this or sit at a desk somewhere? Absolutely no contest. I like doing what I'm doing. And now going back and forth between the two countries will probably keep me interested in it longer, because when I get tired of the managed care aspects of the small amount of work that I do in this country, or I get tired of the frustrations of seeing people who can't afford their medicines, or I get tired of the frustrations of the elderly people who really are no longer able to live alone but don't want to accept work going into a nursing home, then I go down to Peru. And then when I get tired of the frustrations of people who can't get medicines or who can't understand my instructions because their education level is too low or who can't get care for a simple – then I come back to the United States and get renewed there. So, yeah, it's a good deal.
Well, our guest is Dr. Linnea Smith. You'd like to read more about her experiences. She's authored a book titled La Doctora, An American Doctor in the Amazon, published by University of Minnesota Press. Thank you very much.
Thank you.